Good afternoon. Checking my board to see if we have a quorum of legislators. 1, 2, 3. Yes, we do. All right. At this point, we have a public hearing. So let me read what it's about. The Tompkins County Legislature holds a public hearing at 5:30 p.m. in the legislature chambers concerning local law number B, letter B of 2020, a local law amending local law number 4 of 1989, the Tompkins County Hotel Room Occupancy Tax Law, amending the exemptions in section 150-12 of the Tompkins County Code. Is there anybody here to speak to the public hearing, the topic of the public hearing? We didn't get any notice that anyone wanted to, but just in case, I'm checking. A few minutes for unmuting and so on. Okay. Nope, there's no one here, so I will close the public hearing and call the September 15, 2020 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. Would you please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Roll call of members.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna.
Here.
Glenn Morey. Marsha Robertson.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson.
Here.
Henry Granison. Rich Jones. Anna Kellis.
She's there.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Leslie McBean Claiborne.
Present.
She went up there.
Glenn Morey. Glenn Morey.
I don't think he's in yet.
Here.
It's a little delayed.
We have 12 members present.
Thank you very much. We have a quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. You would have received any communications and or notices, right, Kathy?
Correct.
Correct. And we do have a proclamation today. Is Henry not here?
He's just coming in now.
If you'll bear with me, I'm trying to get Henry Granison in.
Yes.
Thank you, Henry. I didn't want to read the proclamation with you without you being present, so I'm glad you made it.
Okay.
Happy to read this proclamation. Whereas the 500-year-old Latinx culture, steeped in tradition and centered on principles of family, community, strengthens the fabric of our entire society. And whereas Latinx people have been a part of this nation from its very inception, their presence, its territories, contributing to shape its society and culture. And whereas many Latinx people live and work in obscurity, their contributions to the common good never achieving the recognition they deserve. And whereas Latinx people serve the United States at the highest levels of business, government, education, science, and the military. And whereas Latinx Heritage Month in Tompkins County is joyously celebrated from September 15th through October 15th, 2020, and whereas September 15th was chosen as the starting point for the celebration because it is the anniversary of independence of five Latin American countries, namely Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And whereas Tompkins County is home to an active, growing, and civically engaged Latinx community. And whereas virtually every aspect of our community's life has been influenced by Latinx, whether it's in arts, medicine, government, labor, business, or volunteerism. Now, therefore, I, Leslyn McBean Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the month of September 15th, 2020, through October 15th, 2020, as Latinx Heritage Month, and together with our entire community, join in celebration and recognition of the Latinx community and salute the Latino Civic Association of Tompkins County for its outstanding work on behalf of Latinx people throughout Central New York, signed this 15th day of September in the year 2020. Thank you very much for this proclamation. I know quickly that the proclamation says, you know, we celebrate joyously in Tompkins County, but I also want to acknowledge and recognize that nationwide it is Latinx Heritage Month, September 15 through October 15. And I know there are members of the Latino Civic Association and also just of our Latinx community in general who are here. I see Patricia. Hi, Patricia. And want to ask if you'd like to say a few words.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate the honor from the legislature. It is immensely satisfying, rewarding for us to be recognized in this manner, and we thank you very much. We thank Tompkins County for being such a welcoming place for us, and I just can't say enough thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patricia, and my thanks on behalf of the entire legislature to all the members of the Latino Civic Association who have been working so very hard in our community, and to all the members of the Latinx community who have been contributing in amazing ways in Tompkins County. You and I serve on a couple of committees together, and I know the work that you do and the passion that you bring, and I know that others do the same. So thank you very much, and I also want to give a big old thanks to Henry Granison for spearheading this, coming out of the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee to make sure that this proclamation was presented today. So thank you, and congrats again on celebrating Latinx Month in Tompkins County. Hi, Ava. I see Ava Lopez as well. Anybody else wanted to say anything? Ava, I see you popped on. Did you want to say something?
Well, thank you.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you all very much. We will make sure that you get this proclamation so that you can display it at your place of choice. Okay? Thank you very much. Take care. Moving on with the rest of the business of the legislature. I do want to announce from Patricia in the chat, she's saying thank you and I will leave now. Okay, bye. I want to double check with Jason that we will have an executive session this evening.
Yes.
Okay. For the purposes of discussing personnel matters in relation to a particular person, when we get to that point, we'll do that. Do I have to reorder any business or any staff or any resolutions here? Any other business I need to reorder before I get there? Maybe consent agenda. All right. Well, we'll take a little time and go through. We have time. I'll go to privilege of the floor for the public. I didn't receive anything in writing. Is there any public who's here to speak with us? Did anybody contact us, Kathy?
No.
Okay. No one had contacted us, and no one has shown up at this point. Okay. Well, let's move on to a municipal official, and I think I saw Dubson. Did I see anybody else? No? Hi, Dubson. Welcome.
Hello. So our last meeting, not a lot on the agenda. We led off with remembering Kirby Edmonds and Joel Harlan. Kirby, everyone knows, but Joel Harlan was someone who came to council a lot to speak on development matters and other issues, and so he became a constituent of mine in the last few years of his life, and we'll miss seeing him at council. Rod Howe also came to update us, and since he's not here tonight, I'll mention one particular thing that he reported on that we're pleased about, that he met with the Postmaster General or someone from town staff did, at least, to try to negotiate a longer lease than the one-year lease that they signed last year that got a lot of attention. So hopefully they will be committing to a downtown post office location. Cornell also came to give us an update on their plans. This was before the rapid rise in cases, but they did note that they noted early on that given the governor's mandate for going remote after 100 cases in 2 weeks, they basically said that it was an inevitability given the 50,000 tests per week that they were doing. But I'm happy to see that hasn't come to pass just yet. We also got a budget update from our controller, and that the tax cap they've calculated at about 1.2% in levy growth. Really low for us in a year when our sales tax revenues have gone down. So speaking of the budget, our first meeting on something budget related was capital projects. Very few capital projects on the docket for next year, given, again, our lower revenues and already high debt limit. Getting close to reaching our debt limit. Some parking mitigation for Green Street redevelopment. As you know, Green Street Garage is getting redeveloped, and we're going to lose a few hundred parking spots while that is going on. Some emergency repair money set aside for public works, some vehicle replacement for public works and the police, and some cast park maintenance. So much lower totals than usual. And I'll note that tomorrow's PEDC meeting, Planning and Economic Development Committee, will have some pretty big topics that might be of interest to the public. The IDA will be, Heather McDaniel from TCAD will be talking about the IDA's workforce housing requirements and expanding the CTAP boundaries in the city. Our sustainability planner, who we share with the town of Ithaca, Nick Goldsmith, will be talking about sustainability efforts. To date, we'll get an update on Carpenter Circle project and the PUD. Related to that, the New York State DOT proposed changes to Buffalo and Court, what they call the couplet, one way for each of those blocks between Fulton and Meadow. And I guess that's it. Also, thanks to Anna for filling in for me last week when I had to go early.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dotson. Are there questions for Dotson? And before I go to questions, I want to say very quickly that I do see the chat. I don't control the chat, so I can't answer you back, but I do see the stuff in the chat. I just want to let you know. Ann Corman.
Thank you, Leslie. Dotson, do you know when is the last date that people can give comments back on the proposed changes to Court and Buffalo Streets?
I don't offhand. It is soon. So actually getting them in before tomorrow evening would be good so that they'd be on the record for the PDC meeting as well. But I'll have to look that up. I forget exactly when the deadline to NYSDOT is.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Henry Granison?
Yes, Dotson. When will you be dealing with the budget formally?
I'm sorry, what? Who?
When will you be dealing with the city budget?
Officially, that kicks off the first meeting in October when the mayor presents his budget to council. And then from there, we'll have several meetings and public hearings about the budget. So, but it kicks off formally the first meeting of October.
Okay, thank you.
I forgot to mention another thing. So we got an update briefly about the mayor's task force to reinvent public safety. It's gotten a slow start. The mayor gave an update that he wanted to include the county, the sheriff's department in that process. And that is the reason for the delay, although I'm going to push him to get it back up because we really do want that task force input as we develop the budget this year, even if the governor is only allowed until April 1st for a report.
Okay. Rich John?
Hi, Jackson. Thanks for coming. I just was hoping you could clarify. You said something about Cass Park and the Capitol. Was that related to the enclosure of the rink?
No, this is for maintenance building and replacing the garage roof. So not quite as exciting as that.
Is there any plan to move forward with that project from the city side? I would assume it would need bonding.
Yes. Yes and yes, but not this year. But they have raised a significant amount of money independently, the youth bureau, I mean, so, or Friends of Cass Park. So, you know, I forget exactly how far they are, but it's been fairly successful, and we do expect that to happen eventually.
Added Fridge? Okay. Martha Robertson?
Hi, Dotson. How are you? I wanted to touch base on law enforcement and responses to complaints about gatherings. I know we're getting details every week or two about how many times, you know, how many calls there are, where they're located. You know, is it Sheriff's Department that responds or Cuyahoga Heights Police, et cetera. Are Kemen Council members getting those numbers as well?
I'm sorry, can you, what exactly, what details?
Numbers about, calls related to COVID and getting complaints about that?
No, we haven't been. No. We've been asking the other direction since Cornell gave out their email form and the county stepped up to respond to those complaints, we actually have not been asked too much about that.
I'll follow up. I was hoping that you and Savante and all the council members and Dan could also get the all those numbers on a regular basis so that you know how many times our folks are responding in the city and how many complaints are in the city. I'll follow up. Thank you, Doug.
Absolutely. That's fair.
Thank you, Martha. Any other questions for Duxton? No? All right. Duxton, as always, thank you very much for joining us and bringing us a report and what's going on in the city.
Have a good meeting.
Are you raising your hand, Anna, or are you saying bye?
Just saying thanks and bye.
Oh, okay. All right, thanks, Duxton. And he's gone. I was just about to say best wishes to you. Watching at the city. All right. Let's move on. No other municipal officials, right? Thank you, Kathy. Privilege of the floor for legislators. Are you raising your hand now, Anna?
I am this time.
Okay.
I just wanted to note two things that are coming up. One, there is an announcement from the Tompkins County Public Library to join them and the League of Women Voters for the National Voter Registration Day, which is on September 22nd. You can visit nationalvoterregistrationday.org for more information on the National Voter Registration Day. And go to the Tompkins County Public Library website for more information on their event. And the other thing, I feel like we should sort of say this every single chance we get, but I wanted to thank, I think it was Martha and others who put together the resolution to urge the federal government to expand back to the end of October for the census. But as of now, it is an imminent deadline. So please, 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 anyone who has not filled out the census, 2020census.gov, anyone still can. It is absolutely critical that we get the count so that we get the right amount of federal funding for all of the important programs that they fund here in Tompkins County. So just a plug once more for the census.
Thanks, Anna. Martha?
Thank you. I have ditto to the census item. And I just want to show the card I got in the mail recently, which I hope other people did as well, about absentee voting and registering to vote and early voting. There are two early voting poll sites, and it's not too early to talk about this. So, you know, people should make a plan on how they're going to vote, whether they're going to apply for an absentee ballot or whether they're going to plan to vote early or plan on election day, whatever they do, it's time to start thinking about it. Two sites, the Town of Ithaca Town Hall, 215 North Tioga, and the Crash Fire and Rescue Building near the airport, 72 Brown Road. And that starts on October 24th. Early voting starts October 24th. And if you aren't registered, you have a deadline of October 9th to register. If you're registered but you've moved, you should re-register it by October 14th. So please, folks should really, I know folks are paying attention to October 9th. You really need to make sure you're registered. And I see Steve DeWitt on the call, on this meeting, if he's actually there. I would ask, I just went to the Board of Elections website. People can get all sorts of information there at votetompkins.com. I didn't see the deadline to register to vote anywhere on the website, and I just kind of poked around. And I would ask that be put really big letters front and center on the homepage. You know, what's the voter registration deadline? There's a lot of information about early voting, and there's information about how to register, but not what the deadline is. So Hope Steve is at least listening. I'll follow up. But thanks so much again. October 24th, the beginning of early voting.
Thank you, Martha. Good information. I was sitting here wishing we had a ticker tape on the bottom so that those dates can be there and, you know, can be burned into people's brains. But we'll keep pushing it. Thank you for that information. Ann Corman.
Thank you. I will be voting the first day of early voting, October 24th, so that's my plan. I haven't picked the location yet. I wanted to bring up something that happened today, in case people missed it, regarding the Breonna Taylor case, and she was awarded by the city of Louisville, Kentucky, or her estate was awarded $12 million today in a civil suit, and the city has agreed to many reforms, and so that is a huge step in the right direction for racial justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. I'll take that out of my chair's report. Thank you very much. Shauna Black?
Thank you, Leslyn. I just wanted to send a big shout out to our child care workers and our teachers and administrators. School started Monday for some kids and last week for a few others, and I know it has been absolutely chaotic to try and figure out how we're going to keep our young people safe and healthy. And it continues to be a work in progress. We constantly talk in the county about how we're building the airplane as it's up in the air. And I think even with education and whether it's younger kids or college kids, we're constantly doing that because this pandemic is crazy and we never know what to expect. We're learning a lot. So I just want to send a kudos to our teachers, our child care workers who are taking care of our young people, because we know that your jobs are not easy, and we respect the work you're doing, and we thank you so, so much. Thank you.
Shauna, thank you so very much for that. Made me choked up there a little bit, so stop giving me a hard time. Really appreciate it and want to echo those sentiments as well. Anna Kellis.
I just got one update from the city that Duxon also wanted to share, that Arnot Realty just won the New York State DOT auction for $3.8 million. That went up today, and that closed. I think it went up today or sometime in the last very recent time, and $3.8 million is the final close on that. So that is the waterfront development. They are also the group that is working on the Bishop's Building on State Street. So
thank you for that update, Anna. Thank you very much. Mike Lane?
For the first time ever in Tompkins County, all of our village elections are happening the same day.
Wow.
It took the COVID crisis and the pushover of the elections from March and April to make that happen. Lansing is usually a month later than all the other villages, but it's kind of interesting that it happened this way. I hope folks who haven't voted yet in their villages, who live in the villages, will go out and vote. Yes, some races aren't contested, but you can pull the lever for one of the incumbents if that's your choice. You can write someone else in if you don't like that person. You can even undervote if you don't want to vote. But you should go and exercise your rights. Villages need people to support them. They're under attack at the state level, and yet they are the one municipality that allows a small group or a small area within a township to be able to raise its own funds, have its own zoning, for example, and to take care of the group of people that live in that area. We think that villages are pretty important to our economy. So please go out and vote.
Thank you, Mike, for that as well. And please listen to him. Go vote. You know, there's some special things that, you know, I want to get done, but I also want to give this good time in introducing Deanna, so I'll wait until my chair's report. But today for our special topic or presentation, we invited some of the leadership at Cornell University to join us at 6 o'clock. And look at that, we're right on time. to share with us any information around the reopening and COVID-19, and more than anything else, to be able to field some questions from us. Cornell has been going around meeting with municipalities and different governmental bodies in doing this, and we're glad that they can join us today. So I will ask Joel and others to please introduce yourselves and then take it away. If you'll just bear with me real quickly, I want to say to Sally, I don't know if you were here for the proclamation. I saw others like Eric Rosario, Belisa. If you had joined us for the proclamation, just so you know that we had already read it and presented it, and Patricia did a fantastic job accepting it on your behalf. So just so you know. All right. Please go ahead, our Cornell folks. Please introduce yourselves. Let us know who's in the room, and then take it away.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be with you all this evening. I'm Joel Molina. I'm Cornell's Vice President for University Relations. Let me quickly introduce my three colleagues who are joining me this evening. Pat Wynn from the Division of Student and Campus Life, and Karen Brown, also with Student and Campus Life, and Gary Stewart with Community Relations. We are really happy to spend this time with you this evening. I'm going to just make some very general remarks around how we are viewing the progress of our reopening. And then I want to pivot as quickly as possible to your questions, because I think that will be the most productive use of our time. I want to preface it. I generally preface my remarks with the same statement, but it's especially important with this gathering. We would not be in the position that we're in if it had not been for the remarkable partnership with Frank Krupa and the Tompkins County Health Department. We say that to every group we speak to, but it can't be any more appropriate than mentioning it to the county legislature. Frank and his team, I'll extend it as well to Jace Molino. I'll extend it as well to Marty Stallone at Cayuga Health System. This is a complicated endeavor, and it has been not only critical, but also quite rewarding to have as partners day to day, hour by hour, the engagement with the expertise of Frank and his team, and frankly, the resources throughout the county. So thank you on behalf of all of Cornell for all that the county has provided to help us get to this point. We could spend a lot of time talking about many different elements. I want to really focus on what is front and center on all of our concerns, and that's the progression of the virus. It was not too long ago, about two Fridays ago, that the health department announced the first in that group of clusters, which did involve a small percentage of our student athlete population, but it was a significant enough surge that we felt that we needed to pay extra attention to doubling down on our efforts to encourage the right public health guidance. We have a remarkable group of student peer ambassadors, a remarkable group of over 100 staff who spend their hours engaging with students, including patrolling the streets of Collegetown well up to midnight on weekends. And I want to be clear that this is not for us to say that we have succeeded, but I am certainly pleased by what appears to be a dissipation of positive cases over the last number of days. If you look at our public dashboard, you'll see the prior 7 days of reported cases and a very low positivity rate. This is the reflection of a lot of work by individuals to do the right thing, and appropriate engagement peer-to-peer, as well as other engagements, not just limited to our campus community, but to every resident of our greater Ithaca community and throughout Tompkins County. We continue on a daily basis to assess, in consultation with Frank Krupa, the ongoing progress. I know that Frank will be presenting to you later this evening. We are going to continue to take close and pay close attention to how this progresses. But again, it is a positive trajectory, and one data point that I think is important to share. As you know, we based our reopening plans on scientific modeling, which predicted a path, both a nominal progression as well as a pessimistic and optimistic progression. If you look at that modeling, and if you look at September 15th, where we predicted we might be based on the modeling, our current positivity rate, the number of cases, is well below 50% of that optimistic projection. So again, it's the right trend. It is not anything that we are going to take for granted. We are not going to let down not just our guard in leadership, but we're going to continue to work with all members of our community and with the broader community to make sure that we continue to focus on really what is necessary, which is a group effort. We have said throughout, and I'll repeat it again this evening, we are all as one community in this together, and we need to continue with that clear focus as we move through the rest of the semester. Very briefly, we're now finishing our second week of classes. They're going extremely well. I heard a report this morning among the deans that many faculty who have taken, frankly, the courageous steps of conducting their classes in person are being met with ovations of applause by their students afterwards. I think there's a sense of accomplishment. Group accomplishment, not just instructor to student, but student to student and one classroom community, that we're all in this together and we're getting through it. We'd be happy to drill down into any other elements of our plan, but I did want to provide that really 50,000-foot level assessment, again, of this encouraging projection. So with that, I don't know, Madam Chair, if you would like to open the floor to questions, or I'm happy to moderate if that's easy.
Thank you. Thank you for that and for sharing that information. And yes, we'll open the floor for questions, because I know that's we were eager to get to that. Martha.
You're on mute.
Again, yeah. You're being profound, my dear.
Very profound. Hello, Joel and Gary, Karen, and Pat. Really wonderful to have you. Thanks for taking the time. We have, I'm sure we've all heard the stories about the, in polite company, the testing of sewage as for group residences as a way of really tracking and catching infections ahead of the curve, in a sense. Is that anything that you've looked at? I mean, maybe you have, and I haven't picked it up, but I wonder if that's an option.
Pat, you're nodding your head. I will hope that means you're able to address it. Please, Pat.
Well, we did discuss this as part of our strategy, and it's actually in the CITRO report that came out in May. I honestly don't know if we have done it yet, but it was investigated, and it was going to be sort of part of our arsenal to gauge the prevalence of the disease within the community. I'll certainly be happy to follow up tomorrow with Gary Koretsky and that group to see if we're actually doing it. I'm thinking that we haven't because the prevalence has been low, but that doesn't mean it will stay low. So it's a good question, Martha, and I will follow up.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I don't know if it's an onerous project to do it. It might be relatively high benefit, low cost. Thanks very much, Pat.
Sure.
Thank you, Pat, and thank you, Martha. Ann Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, everybody from Cornell, coming today. So just this past weekend, I visited my niece, who has, for the first time, has her own apartment, and she attends SUNY Oneonta. And we all know what happened there. And so I really appreciate and everything that Cornell is doing. I see it. I just really appreciate everything you're doing for the community and the college. So my question is that for the dashboard, I often check our county dashboard, and I really like you having your own dashboard now. Because they're different, it's hard for me to figure out how many active cases we have now, and I don't know if that's something that you'll be doing. So, for instance, the county, we can easily go in and see how many active cases there are. So I'm just wondering if that's information you're thinking about sharing.
Let me first speak to the complex process of trying to sync up the county dashboard, the Cayuga Health dashboard, and the Cornell dashboard. There is a dedicated team that works to ensure that there's as much consistency as the general public deserves. There is, as I'm sure you're aware, a bit of a lag time of about 2 days. In fact, we just posted after 6 o'clock this evening results from yesterday's testing. So we'll be able to update again with today's testing tomorrow evening. And that delay is very much with the need in mind to make sure that we are posting accurate numbers. These numbers are not posted until we clarify and confirm with Frank and his team. And so far, I think it's been working quite effectively. We've had a number of discussions. I mean, there are lots of data that we could include on our public dashboard. We have concluded that with regard to current cases, we are likely not going to be adding it, but certainly the level of detail is there. I mean, it's essentially a 10 to 14 day period between a case arising and it would no longer be considered as active. So not that we want the general public to have homework, but we are focusing on what we consider to be the snapshot of the most important, which is how many tests, how many positives, how are we doing on this New York State guidance, and of course the feedback's very important. We're not going to close out the possibility of adding additional data points, but we have talked about that, and at least for the time being, we're not contemplating it.
Thank you. And if I could ask real quick, the confirmed on-campus positives, so that the date for that now starts on September 12th. So are you going in certain increments, not just the past 2 weeks?
This has been a learning process as New York State came out with their supplemental guidance a number of weeks ago. And it wasn't until yesterday that the governor and his team provided clarity in terms of how they wanted colleges to count. And it's become clear, we had originally thought, as did many of our peers, that it was a rolling count of 14 days. To the contrary, and it's similar to how the governor approached the original reopening stages, a set number of weeks, a set 14-day period that is now in the next second set of 14 days, which begins September 12th. And we'll go through September 25th. And according to that new 14-day bracket, I believe we are showing three positive cases going toward that 100 limit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Anna Kellis?
Thank you all so much for being here. I guess my first question is, are you guys finally getting any sleep now that this has started?
What is that, Anna?
Yes, well, we'll have to reintroduce you, Leslyn, at some point to that. It is a nice break every once in a while. although I wouldn't know. So I hear. So question, I guess, Annie asked the first major question. One of the comments that I had heard, and I guess what you're saying, I'm just trying to wrap it into what my brain is thinking. A comment that was made by a constituent is, given that it's a 2 week period, it would be really good to see the full 2 weeks at a time to count how close you are within that 2 week period. And that's what you were just talking about, correct? That you will show.
Right.
Correct.
Right. And we're calling it on campus positives. It gets again to how the governor has framed the supplemental guidance. It is only a count of students, faculty, and staff. I'll start with students. Students who are either living on campus or students living off campus who are taking at least one in-person class. So if you're an off-campus living in College Town and only doing online work, and God forbid you had a positive case, that would not count in this on-campus positives count, which is the count up to 100. But if you're a student living on campus or taking at least one in-person class, or a faculty or staff member that has been cleared to work on campus, that's that count that will go toward the supplemental guidance from the state.
Right. So that I've gotten that from multiple people, that question. Would it be possible to just put an asterisk next to that and explain what that is, that people understand it includes?
There is. There is an asterisk and that language.
I missed that.
Yeah. And if for some reason you find it not clear enough, please let me know. But I think it's pretty clear.
And you are not updating on the weekends. Is that correct?
And we've heard about that as well. Let me say that when there is important information, absolutely we are updating the community on the weekend. Perfect example, the health department those two Fridays ago with the cluster. We made an announcement to our faculty, staff, and students the following day with that information. What we are not doing in terms of the regular updating of the dashboard, we're only doing that on weekday evenings at 6 o'clock. And it really comes down to being able to give our data team a semblance of a break. It is a very intensive process of analyzing a continual flow of data. We're testing over 6,000 members of our campus community every day. And it just became a question of, can we satisfy our desire for transparency and what we owe the community with also giving that data team a break on the weekends? And I think we're meeting that important balance.
And one last question, another piece of information that I had heard that I wanted to give you an opportunity to maybe clarify is that students who communicate with the campus about other students who may not have been following protocols, that they are not held, that information is not held private, that their name as a person who gave information is shared, and that might be hindering people coming forward. So I just wanted to get from you all directly what the protocol is for students sharing things that they have seen.
Thank you for that question. I'm going to turn to Pat and Karen, who are directly involved in that compliance team.
Yeah. So my understanding is that we didn't want anonymous reports because that just opens up a whole can of worms, right? And I think everybody gets that. The idea that those names then are being released publicly, I cannot verify that. I would be very surprised if that is happening. But I will follow up on that and make sure that that is not happening. You know, the behavioral compact monitors and the peer ambassadors have been doing an amazing job. We have a lot of coaches involved, a lot of staff involved, and a lot of students involved, and they are dedicated, really dedicated to this process. So, Anna, let me follow up, and I will send, you know, an email around, but I would be very surprised if that is happening. But I will say, you know, reporting anonymously is not something that we want to do.
So I also wanted to just share that there are a number of online forums established by others in the community or others on campus who may be doing that kind of shaming thing, but not certainly not as a part of the Cornell reporting experience.
Thanks, Karen.
So I want to acknowledge that we have a minute left, unless our friends of Cornell have a few more minutes they can spend with us.
I am happy to not only spend more time, but also to come back at any future meeting. We want to make ourselves available to answer all questions.
Okay, and I have three other hands that were waiting, so I'll engage. Mike Lane, then Henry Granison.
Hi, folks. Thank you for coming tonight and all you're doing. Cornell is a global university, and not only that, it's our global university. It's located in Tompkins County and the major driver of our economy here. I've been concerned about what kinds of difficulties you folks are encountering with the foreign enrollment of students. Particularly, are you encountering real difficulties with federal regulation or even state quarantines that are causing you to be losing students? Could you tell us anything about your difficulties with the foreign students?
Thank you, Mike. And let me start, and then I'll turn to my student and campus life colleagues for additional information. This has not been an easy number of years for our international students, and the added obstacles that the pandemic has presented has not made it any easier. There are different levels of obstacle. There are proposed restrictions that in one case we, along with many of our peers, were successful in convincing the administration to reverse itself on, and that would have limited the ability of international students who were already in the country from taking classes online physically in the States. That was, we believed and still believe, to have been thoroughly misguided and unfair, and the administration backtracked. There are ongoing issues related to China. There are ongoing issues regardless of country related to visas. I am going to give some kudos to our amazing Office of the Vice Provost for International Affairs that stood up a very unique option for our international students. We have, I believe, either 8 or 9 what we call study away campuses, which enable students, Cornell students, to congregate as a campus community, but at a foreign location, generally hosted by another university in another location around the world. And we've had robust enrollment in those study away locations. Overall, enrollment is far higher than we had anticipated. Enrollment is at about 98%, and that speaks to the fact that most of our international students are successfully engaging in their coursework online. We, of course, would love to be able to invite more of them back to campus, and we are working diligently to be able to make that happen. Pat or Karen?
Yeah, so any student that has been able to, you know, jump over the hurdles of visas or other restrictions, we have definitely welcomed them back to campus. We have provided them with the arrival testing and the protocols that they need to, you know, reincorporate themselves into the campus life. That has been successful. We've communicated with them regularly on, you know, any changes that are occurring. And, you know, I think that they have been very thankful to us for what we've done. When we were first thinking about, you know, not allowing any students to come in from, you know, the so-called hot zones, and we sent out a, you know, sort of a, you know, query us if you want an exception. There were quite a few international students who did request that. And when we were able to accommodate them and they were able to come, we have allowed that to happen. So, again, robust testing, you know, robust quarantine and isolation as needed. And I think generally we've done a pretty good job.
Thank you.
All right. Henry.
Yes, thank you guys for coming, Joel, Gary, Pat, and Karen. I was wondering about the surveillance testing. I know that you had some problems initially, but I was wondering what's the compliance rate with people doing the surveillance testing?
Yeah, great question. Again, let me start with the big picture, and then Pat, I'm sure, can give you detail. We did have some growing pains. I think the first day saw some technical glitches that resulted in some very long lines. The great news is our teams worked quite diligently to immediately relieve the concerns, and the following days proceeded without incident. I gave you a sense of the sheer numbers that we're taking on, and again, I received an update not too long ago. The compliance rate is unbelievably high. It's certainly in the 90s, a high 90%. And those individuals who for some reason are not showing up, we're following up with individual phone calls. So this is a very large enterprise that so far is going extremely smoothly. And again, I want to call out the significant number of our colleagues in the staff community primarily who are volunteering to staff these testing stations, and the leaders in our testing lab that are enabling the actual testing to be done and the results to be delivered so quickly. Pat, is there anything else you would add?
I mean, I would just say I'm surveillance testing twice a week because I'm interacting with students quite a bit. My office is actually in one of the residence halls, and the last couple of weeks it has been just seamless. So, I mean, you know, any new enterprise like this is going to have some rough spots, but right now it is working, and it's really kind of amazing. I'm really proud of what Cornell has done and Cayuga Med and all and Cornell Health. I mean, it's just been an amazing partnership, and with the Tompkins County Health Department, we're making it happen.
Okay, I have another question, just a quick one. How's the daily check system working? Have you caught anyone who's had the virus?
Well, the daily check doesn't result in someone being caught. What I think you're suggesting is, are we finding people who end up being tested positive, who
right.
perhaps filled out the daily check that day and said all was well? Yes, there are some isolated cases. And again, we are not bringing the hammer of the law down upon them, but helping people understand and continually reminding our population how important the daily check is. And it's not just during the week. It's 7 days a week. And again, habits are quickly being formed, but not without individuals who perhaps initially are straying from it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Rich, you get the last question, and then we can wrap it up.
Thank you, Leslyn. And I don't really have tonight. I did want to just confirm what a lot of people have said. I am actually teaching a class up at the law school, and I had my in-person class today, followed up by surveillance testing. And I wanted to say, yes, the surveillance testing is quite an operation. It was quick. Fortunately, I got there before the end of the class so that I was mid-hour, which helped. But it was very professionally done and quite a system. I'd also just mention the work done at the classroom level, that the individual colleges have had to reconfigure all of their classrooms and have done extraordinary things where I've got a fairly small seminar style class, but I'm in a big classroom and most of the seats are blocked off, and so that everybody's spread out, everybody's wearing masks. I have some students who are remote, so that IT has been just extraordinary in helping make this whole system work. And I'd also point out the custodial staff, because that classroom is so clean. And there are cleaning products available for me to wipe everything down when I'm done. It's an impressive change we've gone through very quickly to make it all work. And the numbers, you know, knock on wood, seem to be where we want them to be. I'd also say that I've been very nosy going around College Town because that's part of my district. And I have expressed the concern that you can have most of the students doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I think that's the case. You only need a small percentage to drive the numbers up if they're not social distancing and not wearing masks. And the beginning of the school year, I certainly saw some of that. There seems to be less, which I think is really good news, that perhaps the students are buckling down to their schoolwork. Maybe they're getting the message, but we do seem to be heading in a better direction there too. And I want to commend all the people that have worked on that. So that's my bit. I'll stop there. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Rich.
Rich, thank you for that testimonial. That is good to hear, and hear from somebody who is in there on the ground experiencing all of it. You know, Joel, you started out, you know, thanking the health department in Tompkins County and the EOC and everyone for the great partnership. But I also want to, on the flip side, say how much on behalf of the county we appreciate what you all have been doing at Cornell, and your partnership with us and your responsiveness, beginning with, you know, sharing PPEs with us, everything all the way to, you know, some financial support as well. We're all in this together. I remember getting an email from President Pollock that essentially said, you know, with, you know, togetherness and resilience, we are going to come out on the end, other end of this stronger than when we went in. And I do, you know, believe that and want to echo those words from her. So thank you all so very, very kindly for what you have been doing. The only thing, you've heard this from me before, that we continue to ask so that our community continues to have confidence and feel safe is that we all be as transparent as we can in sharing information that people can access, that people have access to getting their questions answered, and so on and so forth. At 4:15 or so this afternoon, I stopped in a store to get some breakfast. Yes, that's when I was getting some food for the day. And the shop owner said, it's amazing what Cornell has done. They have an incredible system put together, but it's hard to control human behavior, although they are trying. And if the humans can only just follow the systems that have been put in place for their safety, we will be so much better off, and I couldn't agree with him more. Our businesses will be better off, us as individuals, our entire community, our public health will be better off. So again, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Joelle. Thank you, Pat, Karen, my friend Gary. Thank you all for doing this, and I'm sure we'll invite you back in another time. Best of luck with what you are doing up there on campus. And let's keep connecting, talking, and making public health a priority for our community. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. We appreciated this opportunity, and thank you all for the ongoing work that you do every day on behalf of your constituents and our friends and neighbors. So have a good evening.
Take care. You all have a good evening. And thank you, legislators, for your questions. I'm sure we have lots more, but our time was limited, and we'll invite them again if you so desire. We are going to, just looking up, move on. The chair's report, and I want to take this opportunity as part of my chair's report. Like I said, Annie gave a part of that report, and then Brianna Taylor. Settlement, really much appreciate that, Annie. It warmed my heart, but we all know that money is only so much. We have to see systemic nationwide change in how we treat and deal with each other. But and on that note, I want to take this opportunity to introduce one of the our newest staff members to Tompkins County, and I don't know if she's still there. Can we see your face, Deanna? Are you there? There she is. Tompkins County made a bold and brilliant and forward-thinking move, and I want to thank our employees. I'm going to get all emotional about it. Thank our employees also for being in the forefront of this and, you know, taking the bull by the horns and saying, you know, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion is important to us in Tompkins County, and we must do something about it and take bold steps. We've been working for a number of years on it. We've had fits and starts. We've done all kinds of things. And what we recently did was hire our first ever Chief Equity and Diversity Officer. And I want to take this opportunity to introduce Deanna Carithers to all of you, all of us legislators, and those who are on this call with us, and to the community of Tompkins County, all our residents. Deanna, welcome to Tompkins County. We know that you're still in transition. That's all right. And just to give you a little background, and I'll ask Deanna just to say a little bit. I know, because I am familiar with Wichita, Kansas, that Deanna comes to us by way of Wichita, Kansas. from Wichita State University. I hope I got that right. With an incredible background in doing this type of work. And we are eager and anticipate the amazing work that you will do in Tompkins County and are here to support making our movement for equity, inclusion, and justice, not just diversity, but equity, inclusion, and justice within county government, a shine, that we become the model employer that everybody is talking about, just being you, being part of the team. So if you want to take a few minutes, Deanna, and just introduce yourself to everyone in Tompkins County, we welcome that. So welcome.
Thank you very much for the very warm welcome. That was the best introduction I've ever received. I had to look behind me to say, who is she talking about? So thank you so much to the legislature for believing in diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice. From Wichita, Kansas to Tompkins County, throughout the entire world, I look forward to helping you meet the moment. One of the things that I've taken from this evening is that you are meeting the moment. Whether we're talking, we're celebrating Latinx Heritage Month, whether we're talking about the citizens looking at the pandemic and that work, whether or not we're looking at signage, transportation, any of those things, that all impacts all of us. And so meeting people from the bottom up or from the top down, where do we meet in the middle? So this work is about all of us. I say, you'll hear me say that time and time and again, diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice belongs to all of us. I am going to be counting on you as leaders to provide the policy, provide the support and the momentum, and you're going to have a staff member who's behind you, including Jason, Amy, Lisa, and myself, who are going to move this needle 200%. And so I've been here. This is my fifth day at work, and I've met with numerous folks, and so I look forward to meeting all of you in person when I'm able to get there. Another just kudos to you is that you've taken time to sit in the interview process. I remember most of you from the process, specifically a person who called out a rock chalk in the middle of the interview stands out to me. And so with that, I'll keep my remarks brief because my actions will speak louder than anything that I can say to you this evening. But I want you to know, say thank you for your grace. Thank you for your kindness. Thank you for being bold, being unrepentant in the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so with that, I plan to just run through the door of justice and continue to move that torch forward.
Thank you, Deanna. If you have a few seconds, does anybody else on the legislature team want to say anything quickly or before we move on? So we have a long night ahead of us. Are you raising your hand, Anna? I can't even tell. And Annie? Yes. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, Deanna, thank you so much for just coming and being you. I read you the article in the Tompkins Weekly to my partner. Just so enthusiastic and excited for all that you've done. And what I keep hearing about you, that you are very spirited and fiery, and I was so thrilled to hear that. You have a lot of vision, and I can feel it. So I'm very excited that you're here. So welcome.
Thank you.
Annie?
Deanna, I just wanted to say welcome on board. I'm very excited to have you come and help us move the needle in the right direction. And I'll keep it short because I know we have a long agenda, and I look forward to working with you. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I plan to be there by the first week in November, and so I'll be in quarantine for 14 days. And then from there, I've read the regulations that are on the Tompkins County website, the public health department, and so I will be there with my internet and making sure that I'm here to support the group. And so thank you, thank you, thank you again. This is a huge honor to be the first. And then also making sure that Tompkins County continues to be a leader in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice, and that we blaze a trail for other communities to follow.
Thank you very much. Thumbs up. There's thumbs up from Amanda and others. So thank you again, and welcome. We're happy to introduce you to our community, and we look forward to meeting you in person.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, we're going to move on to, that was my report. I don't think I have any appointments. No, making sure. Yes. Thank you for the reminder, Kathy. If it's okay with you all, I'd love to do the consent agenda because we have some folks waiting. So the consent agenda are, let me just very quickly say what they are. Resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. I will read the resolutions from the Complete Census Count Committee. Resolution A, urging the United States Senate pass and the President sign legislation to extend deadlines for the Census Bureau until October 31st, 2020 for enumeration and April 30th, 2021 for data analysis and reconciliation. And that was passed by committee on yesterday, the 14th. Under Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Resolution B, award a bid PIN 3755.93, Ellis Hollow Road, County Route 110, Rehabilitation, Town of Ithaca. And that, I am looking at my claim, passed committee today as well.
It did.
Okay. Government Operations Committee, Resolution C, acceptance of Help America Vote Cares, which stands for Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, funding and budget adjustment, ID 9541, Resolution D.
Leslin, can you please pull that off?
Okay, thank you, and thanks for speaking up because I'm not looking up at the screen. So D is pulled. And then Resolution E, adoption of New York State Archives Records Retention and Disposition Schedule, LGS1, ID 9477. May I have someone move the consent agenda? Moved by Deborah, seconded by Ann Corman. Thank you very much. All in favor of the consent agenda, roll call.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Rebecca Robertson?
She's not in the room.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Jones?
Yes.
Anna Kellis? Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corbin?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 0 no's.
Martha's back.
Yes.
You said yes. We're voting on the consent agenda. Thank you, Martha.
13 ayes, 0 no's. All right.
That carries. Moving on to reports from County Administrator, County Attorney, and Finance Director. Who wants to go first? Jonathan on?
I am on, and I get to say no report before Jason's really long report.
You're yielding your time to him. Thank you very much for being so generous, Jonathan.
And I can go next by saying no report from Finance Director.
You're yielding your time, too. All right.
Yielding my time. Thank you very much.
Okay, County Administrator Jason Molina, you're on.
We have our regular COVID update, but before we get to that, I just wanted to give you two updates. But for obvious reasons, I just share with you all that Amy, Lisa, and I had to get new running shoes last week in order to keep up with Deanna. As you can imagine, she has hit the ground running, and we are very excited to be working with her. So thank you for the warm welcome.
Bill, the county finance director.
We had to get new running shoes for sure. She's hitting the ground running. Two updates real quick, and then I will get into the presentation. Frank has some updated numbers he wants to talk about data-wise with respect to the information around some of the positive cases. Rick shared with me today that the Healthcare Consortium Audit and Finance Committee recommended to the consortium itself, the body, which will act on the 25th. So this is still a recommendation, not final, but that they recommended a 5% increase in healthcare premiums, which is what we budgeted, which is good. They also recommended a one-month holiday for December in kind of understanding the financial challenges that are coming with the pandemic. And what that means is we would be given a holiday for one month's payment, which is about $937,000 for us. So it's not final, but it's good news. I appreciate the consortium and Rick and Lisa's efforts with the consortium and what they're considering. So hopefully the board will accept that, and that would definitely help us minimize some shortfall that we will probably experience next year, for the end of this year. The only other thing I wanted to update you on is today I gave a presentation to NYSAC, NYSAC for their second, I think, seminar. They're doing a webinar for their fall conference. They presented on the budget, basically a slimmed down version of the budget presentation I gave last night to the legislature. Orange County went before us. They have not committed their budget yet or completed it, but one of the reassuring things I got out of that was that a lot of the actions that we took, nearly all of the actions we took, were very similar actions that they took. So we weren't far off in terms of our approach with minimizing expenditures this year, minimizing the impact of the budget this year. So that was reassuring to know that we were making, you know, similar decisions as others. And a lot of the challenges that they are experiencing are very similar to ours as well. So I felt that was good to hear that from a colleague from a different part of the state. Just wanted to share that with everybody, and I thought it was a good session. Didn't have too many questions, but it looked like close to 100 people attended, so that was good. I think, Martha, I think you attended. I don't know if any other legislators attended, but Henry, you attended. So I thought it was positive. And we did clarify for Henry and Martha that the EF map money was correct. There was a question about EF map funding and whether or not we used the right money. We did use the right amount. So let me put this up on the screen for you, and we'll go from there. You're familiar with this?
Jason, while you're doing that, I do want to ask folks, usually the large screen is down in chambers, but it's not today, and I'm able to visualize and hear better. So can you all please speak up and into your microphones so that we can hear, particularly me. The others might be hearing, but I'm having a hard time. So thank you.
So everybody, I assume, can see the PowerPoint. Is it moving between slides?
Yes.
Okay. So,
but it's not in presentation mode. And I guess it is. Okay. You've got the two screens showing.
Okay. Sorry about that. Let me see if I can figure this out again. I just recently got a split screen, so my apologies. Here we go. I think I got it now. How about now?
Nothing. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So this is a familiar slide. I think that we're now, well, I don't know how many times we've done it, but we add this to the conglomerate of all of the biweekly updates, or the every legislative meeting we give an update. This is a great format that we've been able to go through. Just a simple update since the last one. We did have a recent spike in cases. As you can see, we now have 300 and a total of 389 active cases. It has gone up quite a bit since the 2 weeks ago. But as I think our colleagues at Cornell mentioned, and I have to compliment them, they are doing a remarkable job, and things seem to be going rather well right now from their perspective. Governor announced the K-12 COVID report card. I can tell you that a lot of schools did open on Monday. You know, they did up in Trumansburg, and it was a good positive experience. So far so good in terms of reports back that I've heard from school districts. A little confusion on the first or second day, but I think everybody's happy to be back at school. The extended the virtual and public meeting executive order, as you notice, there's executive order 63. I think there may even be one or two extras that came out yesterday at the day, but 63 is quite a few executive orders. And there was some clarification that was talked about earlier with Cornell with respect to the 100 cases and how that's calculated. Last week, EOC did call on some departments to train some additional staff internally for contact tracing, to have some supply and some capacity and bench depth to help relieve some of our health department folks. I know Frank can talk a little bit more about that and how that's going, but that was to be able to train some more staff to pitch in when needed. The sampling site moved back a little bit. TC3 went virtual for a few days as they had a small set of cases on their campus. And I think Sunday, the SUNY Chancellor visited last minute notice. I think I let the legislature know, but I think he had a good visit from the reports we received back. And we did get our first report, but I don't think we've been able to analyze it completely from QU Health Systems. About 747 tests so far administered as part of the contract that you approved a few weeks ago over at the testing site, which is, I think, good news again. Communications, we had a few positive cases. We had some spikes and some clusters. I know Frank will be prepared to talk about that, and we had some announcements related to it. Another good town hall that took place. I couldn't make it, but I know Amy and Natalie and Jackie had a good town hall with good attendance. So we appreciate their constant involvement. We'll continue to involve other different staff in different areas for future town halls. And Dominic worked closely with Steve and Elizabeth over the Board of Elections to get some information out on a good press release relating to some of the changes with elections. And that, you know, is a brief overview of some of the activity over the past 2 weeks. Again, you're familiar with this slide, seeing an increase, you know, a constant growth in hours and amount of time committed to it. It ebbs and flows. I do want to give a special thanks to Amy Hendricks, who over the past 2 weeks I've been a little more absent than normal only because of the budget preparation. She's done a phenomenal job in continuing to keep the operation running at the EOC and has done great work in working with our partners and our staff. So I think she deserves a good round of applause for the continued good work that she's done throughout this pandemic. And again, some of the family leave, extended FMLA leave with employees that have to take extended family medical leave for a variety of reasons. We track those hours as well. And some additional costs related. We are getting ready to submit our first reimbursement, and we'll see how that goes. There'll probably be two. There'll be one that may encompass some of this, and then a separate one related to costs from the testing site. And we'll continue to track those and report out when we start to see some turnaround, which may be a few weeks out, but we'll continue to track and submit. I think I'll turn it over to Frank here. I think the rest of the slides are something Frank can talk more about. Frank, let me ask, are there any questions about the first two before we move on?
Nope. I can't see hands, so if you have questions, jump in.
Yes, I did. Jason, could you go back to the slide where you talk about the 100 cases and the clarification? You said it's subsequent 14 days, but not a rolling number. What did that mean?
I'm going to turn this over to Frank and Amy to talk a little bit more about this.
Okay, thanks.
No, they're going to be able to answer the question better than me.
Shara?
Hi, I was actually wondering from the public exposures from employees that work at Wegmans, and I know there was a few at Green Star and Boatyard Grill. Have we seen any other positives from those exposures?
Shauna, those were quite some time ago, but I don't believe we saw any positives result from either the Green Star or Wegmans exposures.
Okay. Is this something, at some point will there be, do you foresee the roles of COVID changing? Because, if we're not seeing people that are in contact with service workers, positive service workers, will we change the way that we do press releases in the future?
Yeah, we actually already have. If you remember back when we had the Wegmans situation, that was early on, we were recommending that everyone that was exposed quarantine for 14 days. We no longer do that with a public exposure. As long as the employee was following all the rules, wearing a mask, we're really just asking folks, one, to get tested, because we have that availability, but two, to monitor themselves for symptoms for 14 days rather necessarily than quarantining. So we have already made adjustments in our messaging around those.
Great. Thank you for explaining that.
Frank, do you want to address this question here that Rich had?
I also have a question.
Sure. Henry, sure.
Yes, the 747 in completed tests, how does that relate to what our estimates were about how many tests would be given a week or a month?
If this is over 2 weeks, then it's probably a little less than what we estimated, but I think it's because that was a short week, also the first week as well. So, Amy, do you have any more? I think it's a little short from what we estimated. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, it's pretty close, Jason, because we estimated kind of on the what we were thinking the high side, and it's pretty close. We're tracking right about on with this, but it is over 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you.
But Rich's question?
Sure. So the 100 cases is not over a rolling 14 days. So if it was rolling, if it started on a Monday, you know, if you looked at a Monday, it would roll and then it would start Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in succession. Instead, what the state has identified is a series of 14-day periods. So the first one just ended, so now we're in the second 14-day period. You get a fresh start when that next period begins. So when this one ends, it doesn't matter how many cases you had. In the next set of 14 days, you start at zero.
Thanks, Frank.
That answers it, Rich.
Yes, thank you. It doesn't necessarily make sense in that you know, but this is New York State, so we all live here, and we live here, whatever they do.
Thank you, Rich. You put words to what we were thinking.
I would say, as a county function, perhaps at the end of each 14-day period, if we haven't hit 100, we should set off some fireworks, maybe some skyrockets. Anyway. Some sure. celebration might be in order. So
thank you. Start a forest fire.
All right. Okay. No fireworks. No fireworks. Some.
If there are no questions on the prior slides, I'm going to turn this over to Frank. Frank can give you a little bit more detail as to what's been going on the past 2 weeks and answer any questions. Frank.
Great. Thanks, Jason. So on this slide, you can see as of today, we have 383 total positives. 344 of those have recovered, but we have seen 110 new cases since the last time we talked to you all about this, and much of it was in that spike that occurred a couple of weeks ago. And as we would expect, we had a spike. And 10 days later, we began to see folks moving over to the recovered side. And so our active cases are below 50 now. The clusters, as we've identified them, the first one was the largest. And as of the 13th, we had 129 total involved individuals, 48 of them positive. And 81 contacts that are in quarantine related to that cluster. So again, we talked about this last time we spoke, and has continued. Most of the positives that have resulted since the last time we talked about it are from individuals that were in mandatory quarantine. So that's the good news. We were able to identify them through contact tracing with Cornell's help, get them successfully into quarantine. And therefore, when they tested positive, there were really no additional exposures that they would have created. And that's when we talk about containment. That's what we're describing. The second cluster was a bit smaller. 52 total individuals involved resulted in 14 positives with 38 contacts placed in quarantine. So a little bit smaller, but a similar type scenario. These are the data slides that should look familiar that we've been trying to present to you at least once a month. The first one, and these are related to our total cases. There's 378 because we put these together a couple of days ago, so the last 2 days aren't included in here. So that's why the number is a little bit smaller. But as you can see, the biggest change here is the age range. Right, of individuals that have tested positive, and that makes sense when we're talking about higher education centered clusters. Probably the biggest notable area is the ages 10 to 19, and what we have found is our clusters have been driven by newer students to higher education. So freshman type students that are in that, 17, 18, 19 age.
I haven't eaten all day.
I'll jump in. So you're saying that in that, ages 10 to 19 are two really different kind of groups. So we're not seeing that among children at home, like
correct. That's driven by the higher education positives.
Okay. Thanks.
Otherwise, the other numbers have stayed pretty consistent. The percentages have dropped because the percentages in 10 to 19 and 29 went up so high. But that's really the significant change that we see on this slide. Moving to race, pretty much
has
remain consistent across the board. Small increases in Black and Asian, but still very close to the county population numbers as well. So really didn't see, even with the large shift in student population, we didn't see significant shifts within race across the demographics.
Hey, Frank?
Yep.
I didn't hear you well. I was trying to find out what are the red percentage signs in the slide before and this one.
That's where they were last time we reported them to you when we had 202 cases.
Okay, you go back quickly to the other slide.
Sure.
So that's the same thing?
Correct.
So if you take that age group you're pointing at 10, the last time we reported we were at 6%?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Frank, on the next one, there's the other category. Can you give us an example of what's in that category? Because that's the only one where that orange bar is way above the total percent in the population.
It's essentially how folks self-identify in their testing registrations. And it incorporates essentially everything else that's not called out there.
Okay, but it is self-identified, so thank you.
Correct.
So is that, I don't see Latinx, is that? No, go back. Are you doing?
So ethnicity is where that gets captured.
Okay.
And so these are the percentage with folks identifying as Hispanic or non-Hispanic. We saw a small increase in the Hispanic population. But it wasn't a significant jump from the last time we reported it.
And Frank, did you see any change in who's coming for testing and how much testing we're doing and any other demographics because switching to the surveillance testing? Anything in patterning?
Well, there's huge amounts of surveillance testing. You heard Cornell talk about between 5,000 and 6,000 tests a day being done. So obviously the population of those students that are being tested that frequently will impact the demographics of the overall testing. So there's been a huge increase in testing over the last 2 weeks, and certainly the last 4 weeks since the last time we reported this.
Yeah, I was thinking more the change for us in surveillance testing that the county went to.
So the numbers at the drive-through have been fairly consistent, anywhere from 250 to 400 tests a day. It really depends on the day of the week. Mondays are busier because the preoperatory testing gets done from the weekends when they were closed. But generally, it hasn't really increased the number of folks going through the drive-through. The funding that you all have provided really was about maintaining what we were already doing and making it available for anyone that's a county resident that wanted to get tested. We were not expecting huge increases in those numbers, and I think so far that's what has played out.
So is it possible that the money that we put towards this might last longer than the 10 weeks?
No, I think based off of what we know in the first 2 weeks, we're on target with what we had projected. But we are in the first 2 weeks, and we're still evaluating the data to see what is happening within those tests that you all have funded. And we'll probably have more information for you in a couple of weeks.
Great, thank you.
This is our municipality breakdown. As you would imagine, with higher education being our driver of positive cases, the city of Ithaca has seen a huge increase. And Jason is pointing out that Trumansburg still only has one. That has nothing to do with the fact that the county administrator lives there. But as you would imagine, the city has seen the biggest increase. Most of the other municipalities are still very similar to what they were when we reported this last. So this is a question I think you all have been asking us pretty frequently, and it's about source of exposure over time. And so what you're seeing here is the blue column. Means that we know the point of exposure, right? That we were able to identify, okay, this person was exposed by this positive case and they became positive. The orange number is where we have been unable to make that direct link. So when you have a cluster, you would expect to see the blue line be bigger. As we've been talking about, those folks that were contacts then become positive and we know their exposure point. I will point out that particularly in September's numbers, that orange 27, there are some folks in that we do think are connected to the cluster, but there's not a straight epidemiological line that we can draw. So we wanted to be very clear that the ones we're reporting that we know the exposure point. We know the exposure point. The others are ones that we were not able to draw a direct epidemiological line to another case. But as you can see, the blue lines have grown related to our clusters that we've seen over the last 2 weeks.
So, Frank, the relevance of this is that the general person who's been careful and is starting to feel like, should I be nervous? 2-1, the new cases are people where we know there's a direct connection.
Correct. A really good piece of news is we have not seen a community case that has been related to a cluster, right? So the clusters are amongst friend groups and people that are close contacts of that individual, not someone in the community that they just had a happenstance interaction with.
Except you wouldn't know that, probably, right?
Well, yes, but we've been able to draw connections for the community-based ones as well for many of them. So we don't have an exact one-to-one connection for any of them. You're right. Could there potentially have been? Yes, but we haven't found anything that even looks close to that being the exposure point.
This one might, if you could get somewhere in a caption or something, a sentence or two that kind of explains the significance of it in plain English. That, because I know that's what people are worried about. I'd be really nice if you could explain that a little bit better.
Sure, and this is one of the data points that we want to provide more regularly. We're going to look at this and likely once a week update this information. So when we post that in that new form, we'll add some explanation to that.
Great, thank you.
Frank, I want to thank you for including this information and having plans to make it public. I assume then that the blue bars include people who have either had contact out of state that they can identify or are connected to a cluster within Tompkins County. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the next slide is actually about travel.
Thank you. And can I ask you one more question on this topic? Because my best constituent is sitting at the other end of the sofa and wants to know why the testing site got moved around to the back of the mall where people who are new to the neighborhood might not be able to see it.
I think much of it was about functionality of the mall. The mall is back open again. And so many people that access the mall do it from the front and wanting to be respectful of the tenants of the mall, it just made sense to relocate. There is fairly good signage when you pull into the roads that lead to the loop that direct you around back to get to the testing site, and the numbers have not fallen off. To date, we have not seen a significant issue with folks not finding it.
Thanks.
So this is the travel slide to get to Deborah's question. So the blue bar are ones where we were able to identify travel related, and the orange bars are not. And so even July and August, there was a lot of folks returning to the community in preparation for reactivation of higher education. And as we've moved into September, there's been fewer of those. We do still have, a number of people that have traveled, not necessarily for higher education, but just within the community for summer leisure travel, those kind of things where we've been able to say, yes, they're a case, and yes, they traveled within the period that would have, the incubation period that would have indicated an exposure. But the majority of our cases, the large majority, there was not travel indicated with the case.
Frank, do you mean travel outside of into one of the quarantine states, or do you mean travel outside the county?
No, we consider travel outside the county just because it is a component, and depending on where you go, it doesn't necessarily have to be a quarantine state where you could have potentially been exposed.
Okay.
And this slide is just a demonstration of the new dashboards that are out. We showed the Cornell one, I think, last time that we presented. Ithaca College has a dashboard that's out now. SUNY has a dashboard for each SUNY school, which includes TC3. To answer a question that was posed to Cornell about the aligning of all of the data, we are trying. I promise we are trying. It is difficult because we're presenting different numbers at different points in time. And so we are trying to coordinate as best we can so it's very clear. What I can tell you is that our data from positive test results, as soon as we confirm that a case is a case, that day in our evening reporting, it's being posted. We asked Cornell to wait until we tell them that a case is confirmed before they report it. And so that creates another lag for them. So I want to be clear that the lag from the date the test is given to the date that it's reported allows for the result to be reported to the health department, for our case investigators to do their investigation, confirm that it is a positive case, and then we report that to Cornell for them to report out on their dashboard. So there is a delay, but it is to allow our process to unfold, because what we don't want to do is report something as a case because we have a positive result, and then through our investigation determine that it's not a case for it could be different reasons. The most common one is someone tested positive 6 weeks ago. They did their 10-day quarantine, and they've been continuing to test positive subsequently. We don't count that as a new case because they're not infectious. And so we don't want to create confusion by causing something a case and then having to pull it back, because that would be even more difficult to explain. So I just wanted to offer that in support of how we're reporting the information to Cornell.
Frank, do you think that the long haulers are not infectious after the initial 10 or 14 days?
Correct. So within the science tells us that 10 days post positive results, you are no longer infectious. The one caveat, there's a couple of caveats to it. One is if you were to develop symptoms after the 10 days, like say day 11 or 12, you became symptomatic, your isolation would start again for another 10 days. So we use symptoms as the primary designator of the beginning of the infectious period. But in the absence of symptoms, it's 10 days from when you tested positive. And once you pass isolation, we then exempt, particularly at Cornell, those people from getting tested again for 90 days because they could, you know, continue to test positive, and there's really no reason to get tested at that point.
Well, I thought you don't release somebody from quarantine until they've tested negative twice.
No, we have not been doing that for several weeks. A negative test, what we do find is many people post 10 days are still testing positive. So the CDC and state guidance has shifted away from using negative tests for release from isolation to a symptomology review. So if you are symptomatic 10 days from the onset of symptoms, you are no longer considered infectious and can be released from isolation.
That's from the CDC?
Correct.
And you feel good about that? I'm just...
Yes. So there are millions of people around the world that have been infected, and the science has evolved where there is general consensus in the public health field that usually within 8 or 9 days you are no longer infectious, which is why we use 10 days.
Okay. I was going to ask also, how long does it take for us to get our results back?
We are getting them sometime same day, but definitely next day at the latest.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right, we got to move on.
I think that's the end of the slide.
Oh,
that slide.
Right on time. Henry and Martha, you still have your hands up. Are you still asking questions, or Henry?
Yeah, I just want to ask about the often asked question about a downtown testing facility.
Yes. I think if there's an interest for a downtown testing facility, I think that's a separate conversation with a provider and the question around who will pay for it and how it will be paid for is and where it would be located would be the next steps to that. I know based on what's going on right now and our actions or your actions as a legislature to pay for the continuation of free testing, that is not part of the calculation. So if there's interest by this legislature to want to engage with CMC for setting up another testing site downtown, I think that's a separate conversation we would have to have for them aside from the funding you've already appropriated.
Okay.
We still have transportation available. So folks that don't have transportation, we still have the cab service available for folks to utilize that.
And how much are people using that?
You know, I saw the numbers. I don't remember off the top of my head. I can try to find that out. I know it was being used. It was still being used. It's still being used. I just don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Thanks.
Yeah, because I'd like to get the, I'd like to see the numbers on that.
Sure.
Too.
Sure. We can find out.
Thank you very much, Frank and Jason, others in the AOC for the information, for updating the information as we go along, responding to requests for, you know, the information people are asking for. Thank you very much. Again, transparency, transparency, transparency. Go ahead, Jason. Anything else from you report?
I have nothing further to report right now, Madam Chair, unless there's other questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a...
Henry?
I have a quick question. I assume that you and Rick did not receive the sales tax information.
I'm correct. I don't know that Rick has been able to process and receive yet.
We did receive sales tax information late yesterday. We have not had time to confirm them against our receipts or even start the processing of the distribution yet. So it was too late to be able to put that together for tonight's meeting. But we should have it. We should have it for the next meeting.
Okay.
Or I could send out a note giving you a brief summary between now and the next meeting to keep you all in the loop. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda?
Yes, I would like to remove from the agenda, the draft on the agenda, resolution, I think it's I. That is the adoption of Local Law Number B of 2020, a local law amending Local Law Number 4 of 1989, Tompkins County Hotel Room Occupancy Tax Law, amending the exemption in Section 150-12 of the Tompkins County Code. And I would like to withdraw it to give a bit of space between when we had the public hearing and when we vote on this, and it will also give time to circulate a survey that the Department of Planning and Sustainability put together. I can share a link with everyone that was just completed, and that is being sent around to short-term rental lodging and all rental lodging with 10 rooms or less. And it will also give time for our county attorney to connect with and update short-term rental platforms like Airbnb that currently automatically collect the fee for the county.
So thanks, Anna. So that, withdrawing that resolution, maybe Jonathan is on there, would we have to then we do a public hearing since there's going to be a survey going out and all of those things?
No.
No, not at all.
Okay.
We can have the public hearing and
okay.
Vote on it at a separate time.
Just want to know. It seems like with a survey, there'll be more visibility or people will be made more aware. And that's why I was asking.
Right.
All right.
Can I ask Jonathan a question?
Sure.
For the legislators who run Airbnbs, are they allowed to vote on the resolution?
Legislators do.
Let me give that some consideration, and I will definitely let the legislature know before we vote. One more reason to put it off for 2 weeks.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you, Jonathan.
Good question, though, Henry. It is.
Rich?
Yeah, Amanda, you pulled Resolution D off the consent agenda. We were going to send that back to committee. Is that correct?
No.
This is the one on the
administrative
policy manual?
We are going to talk about that under my committee report. We're not pulling it completely.
Okay. Thanks.
Alrighty. Moving on. Standing committees. Did I miss anything, Kathy? Starting with Complete Census Count Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Well, we're coming down to the home base, I guess, here. We met yesterday and talked about where we are with the census program. Mostly we're in the mode of trying to publicize to people who have not yet responded to the online requests. They are being followed up by the census workers who are going door to door if they have not put in their responses. Remember, at the very beginning of the census effort, our county worked with the census people to identify all of the housing units in the county. And so that's the what they're using in order to check to see whether the people are responding in those units. You saw the resolution that was on consent agenda requesting that the time to follow up on those units be extended until October 31st. As of today, it's going to end on September 30th. I appreciate the effort that was done on that resolution. Thank you, Martha, and the Tiger Committee for your work there. Our public information advisory board, and also certainly Dominic Recchio, our public information officer, has been doing an outstanding job trying to get out the word, particularly on social media. There are signs available for people to put in their yards. There's some sitting right here in the legislature chambers. If you haven't taken one or two and put them out in your neighborhoods or in your municipalities, please do that. It's so important that we have this. Michael Kaplink-Alaire, who is the census specialist now for 9 counties, did join us at our meeting and updated us as of Monday. Our response, self-response rate, those are the people who are going online, was at 62.7%. It was a little bit ahead of the 2010 response rate that we had, so that was good news. New York State overall is self-response is about 62.3%. So we're just a tiny bit ahead of that. New York State overall is 91.3%. Those are the ones also that have been followed up on by the census workers. We don't have that figure for Tompkins County, but we think he thought it would be similar to that. And the other point was that the two college representatives from Ithaca College and Cornell University, Kate Supron and Doreen Heptrick Atkins, reported that Cornell at this point has not only provided all of the names of the people in the group residences for counting, but also has provided the off-campus addresses for people who were here on April 1st to the census. That was a lot of work, and I know IC is also in the effort to get the off-campus people, those addresses into the census workers. So there's a lot going on. We're going to have another meeting in October. After that, I'm not sure whether we'll have more meetings or not. We'll have to see where we are at that point. But we kind of thought we were going to end in June, but we've, along with everything else, have been pushed back, and the efforts is still continuing.
Thank you, Mike. Questions for Mike? I have a quick question. Thank you, echoing to the Tiger Committee for the resolution. Do we know, are there other municipalities that are passing similar resolutions and sending them along, or we're joining a group of people doing it?
I haven't heard, but there's been a lot of public publicity in some of the adjoining counties' media about the census.
How about the census?
I don't know whether they've actually been sending letters from municipalities or not.
Martha, do you know?
No, I don't really, but I was hoping that I see the resolution says National Association of Counties, and I had meant to suggest to Mike that the committee include NYSAC, and I don't know if that was when the dog got loose or something, but could that just be added, and so that NYSAC gets this resolution too?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Kathy's nodding her head.
Kathy's nodding yes, so if we can send it along to our colleagues and ask them to do the same, that'll be great.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you, Mike. It is 7:30. It is time for our break. Let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back here at 7:40. All right. Show yourself so I know you're there. I see Amanda. I see Henry. I see Mike Lane. I see me. I see Martha, Deborah. All right. I think we're good to go. Thank you all very much for getting back here so quickly. We'll resume our legislature meeting. Picking up with Downtown Facilities Committee. Dave, anything from you?
No, we did not have a Downtown Facilities this month. However, we're planning on having one next month on the 8th.
I think that's it, next month on the 8th?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Is there a time for that?
Is there a time, Dave?
I'm sorry, I don't have that right in front of me. We haven't had one, so I'm not sure what it is.
I have it on my calendar.
Have to look it up.
I have 4 o'clock on my calendar.
Okay.
I have 3 o'clock. Right,
we'll confirm which one it is. Just meet in the middle. 3:30.
Yeah, 3:30.
We'll confirm the time and Dave will let us know.
Okay,
thank you.
Sorry about that.
Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. The Public Safety Committee will be meeting this Thursday, September 17th at 3 o'clock on Zoom. And I once again remind the public that you can make public comment if you contact Kathy Covert at the Legislative Chambers. I have one resolution I'd like to present. This is Resolution F, document ID 9473, appropriation from contingent fund replacement pay reimbursement, Sheriff's Office. And I assume that budget, capital, and personnel reviewed it today as well, Martha? Yes? With that proviso, I would so move.
Eric, may I have a second too? Seconded by Anna Kellis. Discussion. All right, let's take a vote.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Corman?
Yes.
Leslin McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no's.
That carries. Rich, may I ask you a question? At one point you had talked about having a conversation with law enforcement and probably community members if they wanted to on, you know, some of the things people were protesting around or reinventing police or reimagining. Did that ever happen? And Did anything come of it?
We had talked about doing that, but then thought it made more sense to delay that. And I think that's been subsumed, if I can use that word, by the group from the county and the city that are now looking more broadly at police reform. So, okay. No, not yet, but it's happening.
All right, cool beans. Question from Mike Lane.
Rich, apparently the city council people are not getting the reports about who's investigating the COVID complaints. We are. I know that you were intending to look into that. Has there been any progress made as far as the city police agreeing to respond to COVID complaints?
Perhaps Jason or Frank have some other news, but I'm not aware of any progress. I've continued to have conversation when I can with the Common Council members. I think, again, this is something where we should have a consistent and coordinated response, that this is public welfare in its purest sense, and we should be acting to do the best job we can, and having the assistance of the city in that would be, I think, is logical and sensible. But, you know, the response I've gotten is that it's different, that this is not typical policing. It's hard, and it's outside of what they've undertaken to do. You know, we'll continue the conversation as far as I'm concerned. But, well, no, we have not reached an agreement.
I'm agreeing with you, but, you know, I'm not saying that – I don't think that our fewer sheriff's deputies are any better equipped or better trained for this than the city police are. When the governor asked law enforcement agencies, he just didn't ask county sheriff's departments to do the enforcement of the COVID complaints. He asked all law enforcement agencies, and we know across the county other smaller municipalities are also taking up to respond. I don't want this to be a fait accompli where simply because, you know, we allow it to happen, we put on extra details at the sheriff's department. I don't think we should just allow that. I think we should do our share. I don't have any problem with that. But I think we should not accept the city's position that it doesn't know how to do this.
Mike, it's my turn to say I agree with you.
Several of us.
The Public Safety Committee, yeah, we're meeting on Thursday. I think this is a reasonable thing for the committee to take up in conversation. And if there's a, you know, an action that we agree to, in a more formal nature. I mean, I've tried to have conversation with Common Council members. I've written to the ones that share representation of the Collegetown area. I've received responses from two of the four, you know, and we've had good conversation. The other two didn't respond. You know, I don't know. I'm happy to push harder on this.
I appreciate your efforts here, Rich. I want you to know that. But I think at some point we've got to make it known that this just can't continue in the mode it is now.
Thank you, Rich. Jason, I saw you lit up before I go to Martha. Did you have something to add? And I'll add as well my conversation.
No, I just want to let Mike know that what Rich has said is where we are right now. There hasn't been any changes since what we originally started. I know the number of calls this past week dropped off significantly. I think there were a total of 6. 2 were responded to by the city. 4 were responded to by us, but I'm presuming those 2 by the city were noise complaints, not necessarily gathering or mass complaints.
Thanks.
Martha.
Well, I would say if there's enough noise that somebody should file a complaint, there might be more than 10 people or, okay. I think this is in the category of we can ask. I don't know that we can make the city do anything. My question was about something that Duxton said. He talked about the city's law enforcement task force and it sort of sounded like the one that you're leading up, Jason, but I'm not sure. Is there one or are there two of these task forces?
I think it's the same thing that we're talking about as a joint effort between the county and the city for with the Center for Policing Equity. I don't think there's anything else.
Okay, and that involves the village police departments as well?
Yes, we're trying to figure out a way to incorporate everybody so there's participation with everyone.
Okay, and that's Rich and Leslin are also involved in that. So there's just one. Okay, that was my question.
As far as I know, unless there's something else I'm not aware of. But, yes.
Martha, I think there was some confusion because we started at the county side and the city started, and then the two groups were joined together. But they started out individually, so it seemed like there were two. But there's
okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Ann Corman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the village of Trumansburg, as far as the law enforcement redesign I can't remember exactly what the word is, the task force. But so the village of Trumansburg has said that the city and the county are working on something first and that the villages are going to be incorporated in this later. So the Trumansburg Police Department is going ahead and trying to do their own. So I just wanted to say that and also confirm that that's accurate on your side.
They're certainly under the governor's executive order, and Jason, correct me. They're perfectly able to do it on their own. They're invited to participate with the city and the county as well as any of the other police agencies in the county. And frankly, if they need assistance along the way, I believe we would be prepared to do that. The where I think the towns and villages can get some benefit is that you're going to get some economy of scale with really the resources of doing data analysis and looking at policies and procedures and basically getting a lot of feedback. But if they want to proceed on their own, they're allowed to do that. Is that right, Jason? Did I say anything wrong?
Yes. I mean, it's not a perfect system or a setup or a process, primarily because there was no guidelines for a process. So everyone is kind of dealing with the same challenge of every municipality that has a law enforcement agency has to go through the same process to have similar, you know, similar community dialogue. So our intent was to involve everyone in a community discussion or discussions and approach, you know, to try to do as much as we can collectively, but each municipality that has a law enforcement agency has to submit its own plan, you know, reforming or its own police reform plan. And it's just, to be frank, you know, it's been, trying to start collectively has been a challenge. In the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of budget processes that are not aligned, at the tail end of summers where you had some people taking time off, it's been a very difficult thing to schedule and to get collectively on the same page. At the same time, there's no structure or guidance to how you go about doing it. So it's just been I think it's been challenging for a lot of reasons to get everyone together and moving in the same direction. Nonetheless, we're communicating with the city and CPE, which is the Center for Policing Equity, trying to put together a timeline. I know when we have some more information, probably in the next week, we'll send it out to the legislature to give you an update on it. And it's starting to move and get some momentum. It's just been, it's been a little complicated balancing it with and getting schedules together and everything else. It's just been, there's a lot going on. So it hasn't gone as fast, I think, as we all want it to be.
Thank you.
So, you know, quickly in response to Mike's question and what Rich was saying, you know, I too have reached out to, you know, city council members, and I had a conversation with the mayor about, you know, police response. The biggest concern, you know, from the mayor and from the city is capacity and, you know, not having enough staff to be able to do the response. We, like Martha said, we can't make the city do anything, but we certainly can keep appealing to them to join us in this effort because, you know, the bulk of the calls are within the city. So, you know, I did have a conversation with Savanti about this as well. Martha?
Yeah, we're getting information on the calls where we respond. Is it possible to also get information on the overtime that we're paying?
Yeah, we have a log of it. We can share that information with the weekly cost is.
I think that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, we can include that with the other information.
Thanks.
Thank you all. Thank you, Rich. Anything else?
I just mentioned our jail numbers have trended down in the last few days. We're down to 34. We had been up in the low 40s. So, you know, it might be that there were a bunch of inmates who were state ready that moved on, but something, you know,
better something shifted.
Certain numbers. I don't know what they mean yet. We'll talk about it on Thursday. Yeah.
But whatever is shifting, we will take it. Thank you, Rich. Any other questions for Rich? We can move on. Thank you. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will be meeting this coming up Monday at 1 p.m., and we are going to be joined in our committee by a contact tracer who is going to walk us through the process whenever they receive a positive case. Talk to us a little bit about what it's like. We also have a few resolutions. I believe there are two budget adjustments that will be passing in HHS as well. I also encourage the public, if they would like to come in and be part of our public comment, to contact Kathy Covert and receive the Zoom link. We'd be happy to have people in for public comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shauna. Any questions for Shauna? All right. If you want to hear life and times of a contact tracer, please attend HHS. Sounds intriguing. I'd like to know how it works. Somebody who's actually doing it, how that works. So thank you. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, chairperson.
Well, we had a brief meeting before this legislature meeting, and we adopted the resolution that was passed on the consent agenda for the award of bid on the Ellis Hollow Road rehabilitation. So we're pleased about that bid because it was below the budget amount by about $70,000. And it was well below the engineering estimate by almost $200,000. So, and that work's going to proceed this fall and get done. So that's moving ahead. We will meet on this Thursday, September 17th at 9 a.m. We're going to do some bonding resolutions for the highway department that is required. The other thing I just want to mention quickly is that there was a public meeting on the Route 13 study that's going ahead. It was a seminar meeting in which it was done by Zoom, and people could put in questions and get some answers, as well as the presentation that was made by the consultants. We had over 120 people that came on to that. So that was a pretty good turnout, considering not as many as we probably would have had if we could have had a in-person meeting somewhere at NYSEG Auditorium or something like that. But it was helpful, and I believe that's going to be available for people to view if they haven't heard it yet.
Mm. Well, that's good to know. Thank you, Mike. Questions to Mike under report before he goes to his resolution? No. All right.
Resolution G, appropriation from contingent fund, computer equipment purchase, Department of Weights and Measures. That's ID 9493. I think that also passed budget, Martha, as I recall. So I move it.
Ma'am, second. Seconded by Dave McKenna. Thank you, Dave. Any questions on it?
Vote. Mike Lane.
Yes.
David Pimmer.
Yes.
Glenn Mooring.
Yes.
Martha Robertson.
Yes.
Mike Sigler.
Yes.
Shauna Black.
Yes.
Randy Champion.
Yes.
Deborah Dawson.
Yes.
Henry Granison.
Yes.
Rich John.
Yes.
Anna Kellis.
Yes.
Dan Klein.
Yes.
Ann Corman.
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne.
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries. Thank you very much. Anything else, Mike?
No.
All right. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Government Operations Committee met about 2 weeks ago. We had a really great report from the IT Department, Greg Potter and Lauren Cottrell, and it was very thorough. They walked us through all the different projects they're working on. If you are interested and want some updates, I highly recommend you go back and watch that. It'll give you a sense of what's going on for them right now. Our next meeting is October 1st at 1:45, and we will probably be having a report from the public library. Annette Birdsall, the director, is probably going to be there, and I think that would be a good opportunity if you have questions about the library as we go into the budget. You can certainly come to our meeting and ask questions of Annette. I have a couple of resolutions, but if there's questions on any of that, I'm happy to answer it.
Any questions on the report? No? Go ahead.
Okay, so resolution D, the one that we pulled off, Lisa Holmes asked us to pull this earlier today. So what we need to do is, I guess there's still some questions about one part of this, and we would like to remove policy 04-02, which is overtime and compensatory time, but we still want to pass the other portions of this. Is that correct, Lisa? Okay. So I don't know if I can move to adjust that, or Rich, you were
maybe. Yes, ma'am, you can.
Okay. So I move to amend the policy to remove policy.
Oh, wait. Oh. Wait, Amanda?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't have a second on the resolution yet. So let me get a second, and then you'll move for to amend it. Seconded by Martha Robertson.
Okay. So I'm going to move to remove policy 04-02, overtime and compensatory time, from this resolution.
Okay, so you're moving an amendment to take out where is that listed in what line?
It's in
it's removing policy 0402. See, in the title, it's overtime and compensatory.
Okay. So wherever 0402 exists, because the resolution also has, like, the second whereas that says policy 0402, so we're taking out that whereas as well. Okay. So is that friendly to the seconder as well for those amendments? Good.
Okay. And I don't know if Lisa, if you want to just say a word about why we're taking that one off.
Sure. So it's an issue's come up recently that seems it would be timely if we could have some more conversation and address it. It has to do with a comp time payout among non-management staff. That's not addressed in the policy. It's not addressed in collective bargaining agreements. So it seems like it would be a timely thing, since we're considering this policy, to address it here.
Great. Thank you.
All right.
Any questions on the resolution as amended? Vote.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morin? Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Sean Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Jones?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 nays.
It carries. Next one, Amanda.
Yeah, so next we have Resolution H, amending the rules of the legislature, rules 1 to 3.
I have a second, please. Seconded by Deborah Dawson.
So, yeah, so as you all know, Gio has been talking about going through the rules of the legislature, talked about this several times. I think the committee has looked at rules 1 to 3 at least 4 times. And this is what we came up with. It's been a pretty good process. I really appreciate Rich and Dan, who the three of us have met to kind of dig into this a lot. And this is where we are. So there are a couple of small amendments that I'd like to make, if I can do that.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
All right. So the first one is going to be on your packet page 33. And let's see. It's lines 38 and 39. And it should read, the county clerk shall, by a process determined by the county clerk. And then go on as normal. And I would just say that I did talk to Maureen Reynolds, our county clerk. She feels that that's a good, clear statement to make. It would make the process completely up to whoever is the county clerk and not be a nebulous thing. So that's one part. And then the other amendment that there, hopefully folks saw, there was some email questions about how to define quorum and the majority of the whole. So, Dan, you can help me make sure I get this in the right spot. We're proposing an amendment that on packet page 35, line 28, at the end of that sentence, making it a comma and saying parentheses, for example, if the whole legislature is 14, the majority is 8, end parentheses. And that was just to give an example of, for future reference of, you know, here's what it looks like. And then this is not an amendment, but I just wanted to put out there, and I might ask Jonathan to jump in if he's there. There was a question folks had about, do we need to define a supermajority, which comes up on packet page 35, on line 35. And Jonathan said that probably we don't, but I'll let you speak to that, Jonathan.
Yeah. Confusing concept in that there's a whole bunch of state laws, for example, the bonding law, which says you need 2/3. I don't know that we could come up with a list of all of them. Kathy actually has tried to do a list in the past, but I'm not sure it's, you know, as to those which need 2/3 votes, but I think it's more of an example than necessarily a complete, but I don't really see, and it could change also at any time because they're generally state laws that require a 2/3 majority or greater majority than half. And, you know, I think it's kind of case by case basis. We all know the basic ones like bonds, and Kathy obviously keeps good track of those when we need 2/3 and when we don't. But to try to put in a list, it could change. It would probably be incomplete because we may miss something.
All right. Thank you. So that's all the amendments I had and all the explanation I had about things.
All right. Discussion, Martha.
Thanks. And I really appreciate what Gio has done with this. This is a lot of really detailed and dedicated work. So appreciate it. It's a question for Jonathan. Is a supermajority always defined by some kind of a state regulation or law?
Pretty much. I'm trying to think of any circumstance where we have one that is not required by the state.
I see it. Kathy's raising her hand, so she might have
think of one.
Amending the rules of the legislature.
Right, yeah. The legislature.
Also adding resolutions to the agenda?
Yes.
Okay, so we define that as...
I can't think of others, but, you know, typically there are state requirements. But we could, in any circumstance... Just like we can change the rules of the legislature, we could require two-thirds at some time or greater than a majority. But other than the circumstance Kathy just mentioned, they're typically state laws.
See, with town boards, for example, I think we're all aware of, you know, you have something like there are things where if like a 239 review, a town board has to have a supermajority. So instead of 3 out of 5, they need 4 out of 5. That's simple. For us, it's not clear, would a supermajority be 8 or 9 or 10?
Yeah, well, I think a supermajority means more than a majority.
No, right. I didn't mean 8. I mean, is it 9 or 10? So if I guess if there are things that are like maybe that it's, we say something here about as designated by state law. Kathy, are you saying that in other places in our rules, which I understand Gio hasn't gotten to yet?
Martha, can I just jump in? We requested that this part be looked at in committee. This committee work. Can we do that and we'll get back to you?
The part about the supermajority?
Yeah. Would that
Thank
be
you.
Acceptable?
Sure.
I think the hope was that we would be able to pass this tonight, and that if there was another, if we felt like we needed to define that, we could define that here or in a different rule. We can always come back and amend these kind of details again.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking if it's the adding a resolution to the agenda and passing the rules, approving the rules of the, or amending the rules of the legislature, is it stated somewhere else that those require 10?
Kathy is saying no.
It's just in the rules of the legislature.
Huh?
It's just in the rules.
Just in the rules of the legislature, not anyplace else.
Right, in sections that Gio hasn't gotten to yet.
I think we'll look into that and we'll find out.
Okay, all right, that's great. Thank you.
So let me make sure I understand what you said right, Dan. So things like this, like defining a supermajority, is something we'll send, the committee will take back and take a look at. Thank you.
That's my thought.
Yeah, I'm just hoping whether it's in, if it's in a different section, that's great. If it's something that's according to state law, I don't know if we need to say that here, but it, There could be confusion if it's not clear if it's a 9 or a 10 vote. So
right,
thank you.
So they'll take a look at it, Kathy.
So my question is back to the amendments. Are they accepted as friendly?
Well, okay. I thought I saw the hands. That's why. Anything else? So Amanda offered some amendments. It was the resolution as presented by committee was seconded by Deborah. Deborah, are those amendments friendly to you? Yes, they are. Sorry, I caught you in the middle of your muffin eating. anything else on this? All right, let's go to a vote on the resolution with the amendments, the amended resolution.
Mike Lang?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Stigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Stone?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslie Bean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. Anything else, Amanda?
No, just thank you again. I'm glad that we're getting through these rules. I appreciate it, everyone. Thanks.
LMI, thank you again, Rich and Amanda and Dan, for doing the deep dive on these as part of the GEO committee. And everybody, please understand, and it doesn't mean that it's a full done deal. The committee will still be looking. You still have time for amendments, et cetera. And we still got a whole lot more, many more rules to go. Thank you, Amanda. Next committee. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Yes, the P Committee has not met since our last ledge meeting. We will be meeting at 1:30 on Monday, the 28th, and I don't know yet what exciting things will be on our agenda, but I promise they will be profound and interesting.
Exciting. Thank you. Thanks, Deborah. All right. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met, the regular committee met yesterday, and a number of resolutions that went through will be on future agendas or were on there tonight. One is about, I guess the next ledge meeting is about scheduling a public hearing. It had been in the resolution to the public hearing would be November 10th, starting at 5:30. The committee changed that to 7 o'clock, as we have usually had our public hearing. So I suppose that could be up for debate if when it comes to the full legislature, if you want to change that. One very interesting report we had is from Lisa Holmes about the personnel child care issues. She has, Department of HR has done a couple of surveys of our employees, and it seems there's a real problem for not a huge number, but maybe 10 or more staff members who really can't do their work without childcare, and the phrase extreme critical need was the response on the survey. Lisa thinks there may be more. And Lisa, if you want to add to or correct that, anything I'm saying here is just from my own notes. And it seems especially because there is like basically no school-age child care. And in terms of even if there is the child care available, people's budgets don't usually include child care for their school-age kids. That's called school taxes. So that we have a number of our employees who have a very serious problem, and I know how fabulously stressful that is on even an every day-to-day basis. So we did ask, there aren't that many options. The YMCA is, Lisa did a bunch of research, talked to Sue Dale Hall at the Child Development Council and some others. The YMCA is working to ramp up and open up a school care program. I understand GIAC has some students, but Leslie, we heard that you're full. So we didn't have any answers. We just thought this is a really important issue and asked Lisa to continue following up. She's following up with individual employees, and I'm so sympathetic about this. I don't know if there's anything that we can do. And I would love Lisa to mention, to fill us in if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Thank you, Martha. I think you summarized it well. We were just compiling the results of the last employee survey that we did. We know it's quite time sensitive with decisions that employees need to be making and school districts announcing their plans and so forth. So I'm just going to be trying to gather more information about potential options and bring whatever I have gathered back to you all for further discussion and potential action.
So we understand you are reaching out to the individual employees to help problem solve and connect them. That's really appreciate that. So.
Yeah, reaching out to both employees, but also reaching out in the community to see if there are other options and what we might be able to put together.
Really, really appreciate that. Thank you very much. It's a tough one. So that was the regular budget committee, and as the regular budget committee will meet again October 12th at 3:00. As the expanded budget committee, you all know that we met last night, and our next meeting will be this coming Monday, the 21st. We are expecting our budget books to be, the printed budget books, to be ready Friday for us to pick up in the legislature office. And if Jason wants to change that or modify that or confirm.
I think we are set. It's going to go to the printer tomorrow. Unfortunately, we had some glitches last night, and it was removed from the website, and I think it's back now, which is good. Last I checked at 4:30, it looks like we should be on track to get it to the printer tomorrow, and you should have books available by Friday. So okay. I apologize for the inconvenience it's caused. The software was a little uncooperative this year. We're not quite sure why, but I think we're ready to go.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks, everybody, for working through the first four departments that we did last night. It's a long list of departments for Monday night, which I don't need to review. I do want to ask, I don't think we made it clear, if the legislators have questions, Jason, do you want those to go to, say, individual department heads or be routed through Kevin? How would you like us to work on, questions that come up?
I think if legislators have questions for department heads, you can send them to the department heads and CC, Kevin on it. Okay. Or CC Kevin and I on it. This way, multiple people get them, and we'll make sure that we're prepared for it. That's probably the best way to ensure, because there may be questions that, overlap between both of us. But I think that would be the best option. And this way, and we can let department heads know as well that, questions may be coming in. And if that's the case, we'll keep an eye out for it.
Good. And I wasn't sure, how is the public able? Is the public able to watch like they can watch today?
Yes.
That's available. Okay. Great. Thank you very much. That's my report.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Jason, for the offer of legislators reaching out to department heads. I will encourage my colleagues, please use it sparingly and absolutely if it's necessary to do that. We want to get answers, but let's not overdo it either. Mike Lane, questions to Martha.
Yes,
or Jason or whoever.
Martha, we talked about the next budget meeting, but I think that's scheduled on a holiday, so aren't we going to have to reschedule that?
The 12th, that would be Indigenous Peoples Day, I assume. Is that
Columbus
right?
Day, yes. Both.
Right. Good point, Mike. We will get on it.
Okay.
And Leslie, I guess with all due respect, I think sometimes email can be a vehicle to get to take care of questions, so we're not spending more time in the EBC meeting. So
I understand that. I'm just saying let's use it sparingly. That's all.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a question, and now I forgot. You all will oblige me if it comes back to me. I did have a question, Martha. No, I don't know.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee and Corman Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have not met since last meeting. Our next meeting is Wednesday, September 23rd at 3:30, where we're going to be starting the review of the diversity policy, and I will send that out ahead to people so they can start to take a look at it. That's all I have.
Thank you very much, Anne. Any questions for Anne Forman? Okay. Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met on September 2nd, and our next meeting is October 7th at 11:30. What's kind of funny, when I go back and read the notes, like a month later, it's or 2 weeks later, it's old news. You know, the stuff that we're hearing about from the representatives, you know, the folks we're talking with, changes so fast. On the other hand, Amanda Spellacy from Schumer's office, it's like, it's always, well, there's still no federal bill. So, but the details do change. So we did hear from Amanda Spellacy. Micah Plinkelaer from the census came in and talked with us. That was a great conversation, and that resolution came out of that conversation. For the first time for this committee, we also had Barbara Lifton come and talk with us. So that was a great opportunity to hear from her. And Cornell folks, Charlie Krasansky and Diane Miller and Allison Hunt from Tom Reed's office also joined us. It occurred to me later on, and by the way, if anybody really wants to know kind of in more detail what we've done or what was discussed, go to Katrina's minutes. Katrina's wonderful minutes, and it's almost a textbook in current events. So I would urge that folks, if you're interested in more of the details, that's available. But it occurred to me afterwards, I'm like, gee, what are we doing in this committee? Are we just, you know, is this actually getting us anywhere? And I realize we're lobbying them just by having, you know, our federal and state representatives talk to us. They hear directly what our questions are, what our concerns are. So it's kind of monthly lobbying and to really creating a relationship. And I think that's valuable. I hope it's valuable. And, you know, sometimes specific things come out of it. Sometimes it's just a continuing conversation. But that's where we are. And I'm sure it'll be a whole nother conversation on October 7th. So that's my report.
Questions to Martha on Tiger Committee? No? Thank you, and thank you all for your work. And I just remember what I was going to say. It wasn't a question. Okay. It actually was just a quick comment since you mentioned GIAC. I'm just thinking in terms of childcare that so many childcare facilities have reduced capacity because of COVID. And so if we can encourage other folks in the community, to be offering childcare, maybe some people who are out of work, whatever it is, I don't know what sort of incentives, if we can be thinking along that line through Child Development Council or TCA or wherever to encourage that, it will be great. I know at GIAC we usually accommodate 200 and something plus children in the after school program, and we're down to probably being able to do 50 at best, with proper spacing and distancing and that sort of stuff, you know, having the space measured. So I know for a lot of facilities, that is very difficult. So it's a great big need in the community.
And to add to that, Leslie, Lisa and I, you know, we talked about maybe the Child Development Council would be trying to encourage home care. I mean, if somebody has got their own kid or a couple of kids that they're taking care of at home, if they could bring in another kid or two or three, because it's not the same, obviously, as infant and toddler care. It might be something where individual families, and I think this is happening informally anyway, but that's, I think, to be encouraged.
Yeah,
and I did want to mention, I should have mentioned, that I also saw this come across the into my inbox today. Problem Solver Caucus, you know, Congressman Reed with a number of other, it's a bipartisan caucus. They did announce a, and I've lost the, I'll forward everybody the email. They did announce a package that they're promoting for a COVID relief bill, and it's, I think, $1.5 trillion. So it's more than the GOP Senate bill, and it does include state and local aid. So I will, I'll look into it. Maybe Mike Sigler has read that and has, you know, knows more detail off the top of his head.
Yeah, not off the top of my head, I don't.
Okay. So I'll forward that, but maybe that's going to be some movement. At least something else might be happening.
Thanks, Martha. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis, Chair.
We will be meeting next on September 24th. That is a Thursday at 9:30 a.m. I have a few just updates of things that have been happening between last meeting and this next meeting. The issues, of course, in HED that have come to light, or at least that have gotten more attention because of COVID. Broadband has become a central discussion. A lot of municipal officials are hearing from constituents of pretty severe situations that are limiting their children's ability.
Anna, you're very faint.
Can't hear you at all.
Thank you, Mike.
Mike, I don't know. Can you guys hear me now?
That's better.
Wonderful. I'll just lean in, so if my face gets uncomfortably close, I apologize. So hopefully this will be helpful. So, you know, one of the biggest issues that people are hearing about, constituent or municipal elected officials that I'm hearing, is some pretty heartbreaking stories of children not being able to attend school, of people not being able to do their work effectively because of a lack of broadband. ST8, that we have been a member of for 3 years, reached out to all Tompkins County municipal town supervisors, city and villages as well, to participate in a mapping project for gaps in broadband that is just a baseline, superficial, but it would give a sense of where we might have gaps in Tompkins County. So that ST8 can start moving forward in a regional federal grant process of getting funding. They are just in preliminary phases. We have had conversations with the Southern Tier Network that has been building out dark fiber in 5 counties surrounding us for over a decade. They are much further along, so we've been having conversations with STN. And the idea is to have, as many municipalities are talking about, is municipal broadband, but not individual by individual municipality, but rather all municipalities working together for a potential regional municipal approach. That is what STN is doing. So I have been networking with all of the municipalities, STN, Katie Borghella, Deborah, and Mike Sigler have been in some conversations. Spoke to Mark Whitmer today. It looks like STN, Steve Manning, will be presenting to the next TCOG meeting. There will be a special meeting on September 24th or at their next scheduled meeting, October 22nd. I will pass out information to all of you when I find out when that is. That's something I'm currently working on. There is also a meeting that was held previously 2 weeks ago with Steve Manning that was introductory, and as soon as I have that recording, it is being converted by ST8 to YouTube, I'm going to share it with everybody. So there's a lot going on with respect to broadband. I'm sure you have all heard from constituents about, you know, these heartbreaking situations. So I'll just try and keep everybody as up to date as possible on trying to get municipalities together to have a collective approach to solving the problem. So it's a lot, it's complicated, but you know, it's important conversation to be having. the two other things, our housing development fund that Martha chairs, we will be meeting this fall. The IDA did pass a workforce affordable housing policy.
I really can't hear you at all. I'm looking to see if your lips stop moving, so I know that you're done. But I can't hear you.
I don't know what to
do. There you go. When you move in like that, I can hear you.
All right. So I just gave an update about housing. The last thing is that we will have monthly reports about workforce development. That is the other big issue that we are working on in housing and economic development. So broadband, housing, and workforce development. There will be a presentation by TCAD this month coming up on workforce development as well as their work strategy for next year. And that is my full report.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm having a real hard time hearing you. I think I heard you said something about broadband. I had a question that's being discussed in the committee.
It is being discussed in the committee.
And okay.
I am working on connecting with all the municipalities and having a presentation from Southern Tier Network at TCOG.
Okay. Thank you. That was nice and loud. I heard that. Any questions for Anna? Dan?
I would just add, too, that Sarah Schnabel, council person from the town of Danby, is organizing a multi-town broadband meeting. I know Anna's going to be there as well. Unfortunately, it's the night of the EBC meeting, so we're it's going to be not be able to spend the whole time at that meeting. But if anybody wants to let their town board members know that this meeting is going on. It's Thursday, September 24th, 5 o'clock. And if you contact Sarah Schnabel at the town of Danby, she can hook up with the Zoom link.
Thank you, Dan.
And I appreciate, Dan, part of what she is trying to do, and I super appreciate it, is to help all of the municipalities update each other on their needs and what they've been doing so that we can really start to coordinate between the municipalities. The worst thing, I think, would be for all of them to be competing for the same funding. Best if we're all working together.
Agreed.
Well, fantastic. Thank you, Anna. Anything else?
That is everything.
All righty, then. We have no member filed resolutions, minutes of the previous meeting. Moved by Dev Dawson. May I have a second, please? Second by Amanda Champion. Discussion on the minutes. Anything? Any changes that are substantive that you need to tell us about? Y'all are so wonderful. Thank you. Vote on the minutes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Ben Warren?
Yes.
Mark Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Schubert? Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich Dunn?
Yes.
David Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Portman?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no.
That carries. Unfinished business. I do believe our electronic systems are rebelling from a use and abuse. Things are shutting down and carrying on, not letting us get the budget done, everything else. We are going to go into executive session. I don't believe there's any action that will be taken when we get out of executive session. May I get a motion to go into executive session? Moved by Ann Corman for the purposes of discussing personnel matters about a particular person, seconded by Anna Kellis. All in favor of going into executive session? We got to do a roll call vote again.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
David McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
No.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Henry?
I think Henry's frozen in time. Let it go. Let it go. Oh, sorry.
Rich John?
Yes.
I was yes. doing time until Henry came on.
Did Henry? Okay. Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
We have 12 ayes, one no.
Okay, we are going into executive session.